Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project, who assesses the First Step Act, a modest criminal justice reform bill that was recently passed by Congress and signed into law by President Trump. Felicia Kornbluh, co-author of the new book titled Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform in Feminist Perspective, who talks about the important and overdue assessment of welfare reform's impact on women. And Tom Lewandowski, co-founder and director of the Workers Project in Fort Wayne, Indiana, who explains why he believes the U.S. labor movement needs to focus on organizing, not elections. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called for a snap election in April as his right-wing government faces growing internal dissent over national security issues and a growing bribery scandal. The official reason for the snap election was the right-wing government's inability to pass a law to regulate the enlistment of ultra-Orthodox men into the Israeli military. But the corruption cases loom large. Only days before Netanyahu's call for new elections, state prosecutors recommended Netanyahu be indicted on corruption charges. Two previous prime ministers who were indicted were later forced to resign. In the strongest bribery case, Netanyahu and his wife are accused of receiving gifts from Hollywood producer Arnon Milchan and Australian businessman James Packer, which were valued at nearly $300,000. Prosecutors say the gifts were given in exchange for Netanyahu's granting government regulatory relief, including a 10-year tax exemption on income earned abroad by new immigrants. In a separate case, Netanyahu is accused of being involved in a quid pro quo deal with Arnon Moses. The deal would have had the government undercut one daily newspaper, Israel Hayom, in return for more favourable news coverage in another, Yedioth Ahronoth, published by Moses. Much like his U.S. ally, President Donald Trump, Netanyahu dismisses the bribery charges as a witch hunt. The Likud Party prime minister has denied any wrongdoing and is fanning conspiracy theories to inflame public sentiment against the country's police, its prosecutors, and its courts. Legal scholars and political commentators warn that Israel is likely headed for a constitutional crisis. Congressional Republicans have waged an 8-year campaign to cut funding for the Internal Revenue Service while proclaiming that the tax collection agency is biased against conservatives. In 2008, an internal IRS investigation discovered hundreds of foreign companies were not paying U.S. taxes. Soon after the IRS sought $50 million in unpaid taxes, the Republican majority in Congress responded by reducing the enforcement budget of the IRS. Over time, congressional Republicans have cut $2 billion out of the operating budget of the IRS, thus squeezing auditors, tax collectors, and consumer service representatives. ProPublica estimates that the downsized IRS has failed to collect $18 billion a year in potential federal revenues. At last count, the IRS had 9,500 tax auditors, the agency's lowest number since the early 1950s, when the U.S. economy was one-seventh of its current size. As the IRS continues to shrink, one-third of its current employees are eligible to retire in 2019. Thus far, big corporations and wealthy individuals are the main winners of the now decaying IRS. A Democratic blue wave crashed into conservative Orange County, California, defeating all seven congressional seats held by Republicans. Prominent GOP firebrand Dana Rohrabacher was among those ousted. Democrats now also make up a supermajority in California's state legislature. Firmly in Democratic hands, the Golden State will likely be a key testing ground for new progressive policies. But California is not exempt from stubborn economic and social problems. While the state has the world's fifth largest GDP, it also ranks fourth among U.S. states in terms of income inequality and first among U.S. states in poverty. Racial economic disparity is also rampant. A recent American Prospect article proposed a 12-step program called From Resistance to Renewal for the transformation of California's economy, and maybe of America's. Among the policy prescriptions offered were promotion of green technologies and a commitment to 100% renewable energy in power generation, caring for seniors and those that provide them with support, strengthening labor unions, increasing investments in early childhood and adult education, as well as affordable housing and public transportation, addressing economic and regional inequality, undertaking criminal justice reform, supporting the integration of immigrants in the state's communities, and mitigating the effects of climate change by funding infrastructure projects and jobs. If progressives hope to show what they are for and not just what they are against, California, the authors say, is a good place to start implementing those model programs. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
On December 21st, President Trump signed the First Step Act, a modest criminal justice reform bill that passed with overwhelming bipartisan support. Groups and individuals on the right, like the billionaire Koch brothers, and on the left, including Van Jones, supported it out of a mixture of concern about the ballooning cost of incarceration and alarm that those in prison were simply being warehoused, with their humanity and potential for rehabilitation and contributions to society being ignored. Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law and senior counselor, pushed hard for the bill, motivated by the fact that his father served time in federal prison for corruption. Among the provisions in the bill are reducing some 4,000 prisoners' sentences for good behavior, allowing more inmates to serve time under house arrest or in halfway houses, requiring that prisoners be incarcerated in locations no more than 500 miles away from family members, prohibit the stacking of mandatory sentences for specific gun and drug offenses, and providing judges with more discretion to sentence defendants to less than mandatory minimum prison sentences for some low-level crimes. The new law applies only to federal prisoners, who make up about one-tenth of the 2 million people behind bars in the U.S. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mark Maurer, executive director of the Sentencing Project, who examines what the new law does and doesn't do.
We're most encouraged by the sentencing reform elements of the package that were put in by the Senate leadership. You know, one of the longstanding problems has been with the crack cocaine sentencing reform of 2010, which reduced the sentencing disparity between crack and powder cocaine, but was not made retroactive. And so this bill will now apply to about 2,600 people serving crack cocaine sentences in the federal system who did not receive the previous benefits of that legislation. It will move up their release date by 2 years or so. We know that more than 80% of the people serving crack sentences are African American. For powder cocaine, they're much more likely to be white or Latino. Other elements of the sentencing reform, you know, include provision whereby previously the so-called three strikes and you're out policy in the federal system meant for a third drug offense you would get life without parole, which is rather shocking. And now it's still going to be a very stiff sentence. It's a mandatory minimum of 25 years, but clearly less than a life sentence also. In addition to the sentencing reform, there are provisions in the bill to expand programming in federal prisons, and people who complete the program successfully can earn credits towards an earlier release to a halfway house as they get near the end of their sentence.
One of the things in this new law is that pregnant women in federal prison can no longer be shackled, and that extends to a few months after giving birth. I was appalled that that was still going on in federal prisons. It also says women must be provided feminine hygiene products free of charge.
What century are we living in, right, that they're just catching up with this now? It's shameful that it's taken federal legislation to make this happen, that it wouldn't just be assumed that, women in prison have the same needs as women on the outside. And, you know, the cost of making feminine hygiene products available to them is minuscule in the overall budget of the Bureau of Prisons. So it's unfortunate it took legislation to make this happen, but it's about time.
New Haven, Connecticut, where I live, sees more than its share of people returning from prison being dropped off in the city with almost no money and no form of ID, which is a big impediment to getting their lives back on track. The new law provides for people to get an ID before leaving prison. Is that a big deal?
Yeah, it is. You know, it's something that most of us on the outside don't think about at all because we just assume we have a driver's license or some other form of ID. But so many people in prison either had limited IDs before they went to prison or now that they're coming home, you know, they've lost their paperwork somewhere along the line. And, you know, at every step of the way when it's time to get a job or a place to live or other kinds of documentation, you need that ID. And so something very simple like that can make a very big difference.
Mark Maurer, the bill that passed and was signed by President Trump on December 21st was a true bipartisan compromise, but that means progressives didn't get everything they wanted, right?
Overall, it's a relatively modest impact that it's likely to have on mass incarceration. And, you know, some of the elements that could have gone further, mandatory sentencing is widely condemned across the spectrum these days. And so it made some modifications of mandatory sentencing, but, you know, we still have a long way to go to really unpack that. A couple of compromises that came towards the end of the legislation are particularly unfortunate, and those are some of the sentencing reform changes that will only take effect prospectively but not retroactively. So changing the three strikes life without parole for drug offenses, there's another drug offense provision called the stacking offenses, which can lead to decades-long sentences for several crimes that may have happened within the course of a week or two, essentially part of a crime spree. So those laws were changed, but they won't affect people in prison. So in each of those cases, we're looking at probably dozens of people a year being positively affected, whereas hundreds of people sitting in federal prison today will not be affected by them. And you know, it's hard to explain to somebody in the street why a person sentenced the day before the law passed should have a harsher prison term than someone sentenced the day after the law passed. You know, if we think this is a more fair and just sentence, you know, why are we still applying it to people who are already in federal prison?
That was Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project. Learn more about the First Step Act and the movement advocating comprehensive criminal justice reform by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When Bill Clinton ran for president in 1992 as a so-called centrist New Democrat, he pledged to end welfare as we know it. As he neared the end of his first term in office, he signed into law the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act of 1996, which replaced the existing Aid to Families with Dependent Children, or AFDC program, with TANF, Temporary Aid to Needy Families. TANF limited the time period recipients could receive benefits to no more than 5 years in their lifetime. However, under the law, states were allowed to shorten the benefit period, which many did. Clinton's welfare reform required recipients to work, participate in community service, or get vocational training. Those who didn't or couldn't participate lost their benefits. In response to Clinton's signing of the welfare reform bill, two high-ranking officials in his Department of Health and Human Services resigned in protest. Opposition to the welfare overhaul was widespread over the program's serious erosion of the nation's social safety net that surrendered the fight to lift people out of poverty, primarily hurting single women and their children. Your reporter spoke with Felicia Kornbluh, co-author along with Gwendolyn Mink, of the new book titled Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform and Feminist Perspective. Here she talks about the important and overdue assessment of welfare reform's impact on women and the nation at large.
So the assumptions are that people don't need it, that it's just entirely a group of non-white people, that somehow people are defrauding the government, you know, that they're getting benefits in numerous places or in numerous names. Ronald Reagan ran for office in the 60s and when he was running for governor of California, and then later when he was running for president, talking about the quote-unquote welfare queen, who is somebody who supposedly was, you know, getting a zillion different checks and different names and, you know, was getting rich off the system. And that idea, it's just hung around for so long. Our society is really uncomfortable with the idea that there are women who are raising kids without men in the picture, or without men who are supporting the women. And I think it's also a lot of, you know, stuff about race. It's stuff that runs really deep in our culture.
In 1996, when welfare reform was passed by Congress and signed into law by President Bill Clinton, can you speak to what changed in welfare briefly and the consequences for people out there in the country? And I know you've said that people actually have died because of these new policies that were implemented back then in the mid-90s.
What the law did was it said that welfare, this economic support that the government provides for low-income moms and kids, would no longer be an entitlement. And what that means is that a woman who's raising young kids and who gets into a bad situation, like let's say she has an abusive partner, and she needs to get out of that situation. In the old days, if she met certain criteria, if she was poor enough and met whatever other criteria that her state established, that she could be assured that she would get some assistance, right? But the 1996 law said, no, this is no longer an entitlement. That means that you're no longer guaranteed the assistance. And moreover, what they said was that there's a federal maximum of 5 years during which you can get any aid. And that's it for your whole life. So, you know, if you're unfortunate enough to have two periods in your life when you're extremely poor and you get into that kind of a bad situation, if you hit that limit, then that's it. You can never ask for help again.
The sort of punitive framework for welfare persists today, of course. And we now have the Republican Congress recently passing work requirements to get Medicaid. But we have a new Democratic House that will be taking office in January, controlling the U.S. House of Representatives. Are you expecting any kind of focus on welfare reform and maybe reforming what was put in place back in the mid-90s?
I think it is an exciting time. I don't know what the House of Representatives is going to do. I'm not really sure what they can accomplish as just one portion of the government. But I do think that there's a real live debate going on within the Democratic Party. And we started to see it in the 2016 Democratic primaries in the presidential race. And that, of course, there was a fight between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. But even beyond that, I think there was really a fight about the future of the party and about how to assess its past. In terms of an agenda, I see it as two-pronged. I think that we do need to do something more about poverty, and it could be through this legislation or through some other legislation. You know, I'd be open to some kind of universal basic income type of strategy, understanding that mothers who are raising young children may need a higher level of basic income than people who don't have those responsibilities. And I also think that we should be moving forward as a society to do things for everybody. You know, for all of the families that are stressed out and working too hard and having a really rough time balancing between their work responsibilities and their family responsibilities. I know so many people who are caring for their ill and elderly parents, people who have disabled kids. I think that as a society, for reasons that I never quite understand, we just have done such a terrible job of really meeting people's needs. So that's what I would hope a democratic or a progressive or a feminist agenda would look like in the future. If we really do care about families, if we really do care about kids, then it seems like kind of a no-brainer.
That was Felicia Kornbluh, Associate Professor of History, Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at the University of Vermont. She's co-author, along with Gwendolyn Mink, of the new book titled Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform and Feminist Perspective. Learn more about the efforts to repair and restore the nation's tattered social safety net by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. U.S. labor unions have witnessed dramatic losses in membership over the last several decades. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, union membership has declined from a rate of 20.1% in 1983 to just 10.7% today. There were 14.8 million wage and salary workers belonging to unions in 2017, a slight increase of 262,000 from the previous year. It's been 7 years since the state of Wisconsin passed highly controversial legislation in 2011, which virtually eliminated collective bargaining rights for most public sector workers, in addition to cutting those workers' benefits. Funded by conservative activists and think tanks, backed by corporate donors including the billionaire Koch brothers and the Bradley Foundation, attacks on labor unions have spread across the country in recent years, where Republican-controlled states have moved to follow Wisconsin's lead. The anti-union movement was elated when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against labor in the Janus v. AFSCME case in June, a decision that means public sector unions can no longer collect agency fees as a condition of employment, which previously had been mandatory in 22 states. While there are signs that certain sectors of the labor movement have become energized this year, with teacher walkouts in 6 states, that won raises and increases in education budgets, labor is still largely on the defensive. Your reporter spoke with Tom Lewandowski, co-founder and director of the Workers' Project in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Here he talks about his recent article titled, Forget Elections, Labor Needs to Get Back to Its Roots, which argues that a focus on rebuilding union membership should be the labor movement's primary focus.
You know, the labor movement was created out of a culture of solidarity that developed, and the institutions came after the culture was developed. And I think we're at a point now where institutional labor movement, you know, is 10%, and we have to focus on that 90%, build a culture of solidarity, get folks talking to each other and looking out for each other. And that takes a different kind of organizing. And, you know, Donald Trump, a lot of the left is rightly concerned about Donald Trump, fixated to some extent. But, you know, most of us who work have had a boss like Donald Trump. America may have never had a president like him, but most of us who work have had a boss like him before. And so we need to figure out how we can start dealing with him just as a boss, and that just starts with organizing. And I think doing politics alone, and I don't want to dismiss politics entirely, but back in the 1960s, we used to say you don't go to the party to get your act together, you get your act together to go to the party. Well, the labor movement doesn't have its act together. We've forgotten how to represent workers, how to listen to workers. And we've been too fixated on politics as a quick fix, kind of a silver bullet.
Well, Tom, where do you think the existing institutional labor unions, where should they go now? In terms of their loss of membership, they know they have to turn things around, but what are some of the things they could do today to get started in a new direction that will revive the labor movement?
Well, if you look back to the early 20th century, when the American Federation of Labor saw that there were huge amounts of workers who were industrial workers at that time that didn't fit into their model, they put resources into looking for new models. I know that there has been a lot of experimentation with that, but it's always within the constraints of, does it make financial sense? It's still too much about building the organization, building the institution, rather than representing the worker. If there was more effort put into what I believe would be regional organizing within communities and sort of bring together community organizing and working organizing so that people have voice and power where they live and where they work simultaneously, that those become connected more rather than an either-or.
Do you see currents in the existing labor establishment today who know they need to go in this direction? Are there promising signs that change is afoot?
I can't say that I do, but I don't know that there aren't. I haven't seen many. I think there are a lot of folks out there that know something is needed different, but are despairing. They don't know where to start. I think there are a large segment of the labor activists who are desperate for trying something new, and I think they just ought to try it. And don't limit ourselves to just creating an NLRB union. I talk to unionists from other places, and I start talking about what we're doing, and they go, did you win an NLRB election? So, well, that's not the point. We first have to build a culture of solidarity before we start doing that. And that, yeah, we create collective voice and power, but our objective isn't first to see if we can create a dues income stream. That becomes such an artifice that people see right through that and say, oh, you're only interested in us for the money. It's not about solidarity. We've seen the collapse of what I believe is the potential collapse of our democracy if we don't find a way for working people to have voice and power. And we're seeing that in Europe now, too. You know, large numbers of the working class who are seen in the streets of Paris.
That was Tom Lewandowski, co-founder and director of the Workers' Project in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Find a link to Lewandowski's recent In These Times magazine article titled, Forget Elections, Labor Needs to Get Back to Its Roots, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WERU in East Orland, Maine, WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.